passage that I'll be preaching on this morning is the one that Meg just read for us from that great 40th chapter of Isaiah. Our gospel reading this morning, as you see, comes from the first chapter of the Gospel of Mark. We're beginning with the 21st verse, the 29th verse, I should say. I walked away and left my reading glasses in the office, so I'm going without a net this morning. Bear with me here. As soon as they left the synagogue, they entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Now, Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and they told him about her at once. He came and took her by the hand and lifted her up. Then the fever left her, and she began to serve them. That evening at sunset, they brought to him all who were sick or possessed with demons. And the whole city was gathered around the door. And he cured many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons. And he would not permit the demons to speak because they knew him. In the evening, while it was still very dark, he got up and went out to a deserted place, and there he prayed. And Simon and his companions hunted for him. When they found him, they said to him, "Everyone is searching for you." And Jesus answered, "Let us go on to the neighboring towns, so that I may proclaim the message there also, for that is what I came out to do." And he went through Galilee, proclaiming the message in their synagogues, and also casting out demons. This is the word of the Lord. You may recognize the title of my sermon this morning actually comes at the start of the last verse of the great Presbyterian Reformed hymn, "I Greet Thee Who My Sure Redeemer Art." I think we're going to be singing that next week. I mistimed it by a week. That verse, if you know it, goes, "Our hope is in no other saving thee. Our faith is built upon thy promise free. God grant us peace and make us calm and sure, that in thy strength we evermore endure." I've told you several times over the years that if I were asked to choose one chapter or one passage in the entire Bible as my favorite, it would probably be Isaiah 40. I think I could find some other favorites, but to my mind, no chapter, no passage that I might pick could be any more powerful and any more magnificent than Isaiah 40. Isaiah 40, you may know from studies along the way, is the first chapter in what's called the second Isaiah in the book of Isaiah. The book of Isaiah is a long book, and chapters 40 through 55 are called the second Isaiah. To me, the sustained power and the poetry and the theology and the beauty of 2 Isaiah, and by sustained, I mean all through the length of it, those are unparalleled to me anywhere else in the scriptures. I'll tell you one of the moments that Isaiah 40 was imprinted on me, because I think it truly captures the spirit and the message of this chapter. I just finished seminary, and I'd started my time as a chaplain counselor at Medical College of Virginia Hospitals in Richmond, Virginia. And that year, the movie Chariots of Fire came out. Joe, I'm doing a movie thing today. Chariots of Fire is absolutely one of my favorite movies of all time, probably in the top five if I had to answer it. And if you've seen it, it's got some Hollywood touches, but it's basically the true story of two great athletes, Harold Abrahams from England and Eric Little from Scotland. And it follows them before and during the time that they prepare for the 1924 Olympics in Paris. But way before they meet in a track meet, way before they're on the Olympic team for Britain together, they follow these two parallel tracks in their lives. And both of them have to struggle from deep within their heart and soul along the way. Harold Abrahams has to fight mostly from a bitterness and an anger that's deep within him because he's Jewish. And he attends a college, and he is on a track team at a time that Jewish people were very, very suspect and very persecuted. Eric Little, if you've seen it, has to struggle again, but from deep within his Scottish Presbyterian faith, about whether he should go on a mission, whether he should go ahead and go into Christian missions, or whether he should train first for the Olympics. Steve Patterson talked about this in a sermon in August. I know that because I've seen his notes on it. Ultimately, once they get to the Olympics, Eric Little, the Scotsman, is so led by his convictions and his faith about the proper way to observe the Sabbath that he refuses to run in a race that's scheduled for Sunday. Imagine us struggling with that today. It's not even a passing thought. There's a scene in the movie, though, that takes place while they are in the Olympics in Paris. And Eric Little is in this great pulpit in a church in Paris. And he announces his text for that Sunday is Isaiah 40. And then against the backdrop of all these athletes from the different nations competing in the events, and some of them are victorious and some of them stumble and fail and fall along the way, and all that is a symbol for the efforts and the successes and the pride and the failures of nations. Against that backdrop, Eric Little reads these words. The nations are as a drop from a bucket. They are accounted as dust on the scales. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are accounted by him as less than nothing and emptiness. And then, as I recall, he reads portions of our passage today. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the foundations of the earth? Israel already knows what is being said to him. They already know from past experiences with God. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Do you not already understand? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to live in, who brings princes to naught and makes the rulers of the earth as nothing. And then he reads the portion of the passage that we know the best. He begins with verse 27, and this is the center of the passage. This is the heart of the passage. And it's a question to the people of Israel. They are in exile in Babylon as Isaiah speaks to them and as Isaiah writes to them. They've given up hope that God cares about them anymore. They've given up hope that God will do anything for them anymore. They've given up hope that God will ever help them, ever save them again. And so Isaiah comes to them and asks them this piercing question. Why do you say, O Jacob, and why do you speak, O Israel, and say, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God? And then he comes to this resounding proclamation as the answer. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint, and he strengthens the powerless. Even youth shall faint and grow weary, and the young shall fall exhausted. But those who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. The reason that this passage is so great and so profound is because of the way that it declares the incomparable greatness, the awesomeness. When we use the word awesome today, it doesn't even compare to what awesomeness means here. The sovereignty, the incomparability, the incomprehensibility of God, and it does that all together. In these few verses, only God is God. It says no human thing, no human idea, no human imagination, no human pride even begins to compare to God. And it says because God is all these things, God has the power to give us hope when we think there's no hope. God has the power to deliver us and save us when we believe that we are lost and beyond reach. This is who God is. This is what God does. Because God is beyond our imagining, beyond what we can think, beyond what we may feel. And it also says that God is beyond the limits that we try to impose on him. Sometimes unconsciously, sometimes consciously. But we're consciously trying to put limits on God. In my dad's generation of ministers, one of the most read books, and some of you may have heard of it, was a little classic by a preacher and scholar and author named J.B. Phillips. And the book had the not very subtle title, Your God is Too Small. It's about how we attempt to make God in our own image and how we try to limit God to only what we can understand and what we can accept and what we can tolerate. It doesn't take me saying it from the pulpit to you that we can recognize and we can understand very clearly, even if it's hard to hear and admit, how many times we try to make God too small, to make God fit our ways. God's will is limited to my opinions. God's will is for our comfort, what makes us feel safe, what makes us not too challenged, not too threatened, not needing to grow more in our faith, not needing to mature more in our faith, just being satisfied with where we are. God approves even my prejudices. God approves my short-sightedness. God approves my kind of people, and on and on and on. I followed a bumper sticker yesterday, not the bumper sticker, I followed the car, but the bumper sticker was on the back of the car. I would definitely report to you if I followed a bumper sticker. But it said, and I'd never seen this one before, God created man, and Sam Colt made them equal. I was on the way to work on their sermon. Not only is that sticker ugly and violent and idolatrous, but I couldn't see it and avoid hearing Isaiah's words today about this God that the sticker says created, and yet he needs our help and our guns to complete his creation. Even the nations are like a drop in the bucket and are accounted as dust on the scales. To whom will you liken God, or what likeness compare with him? And then the next verse says, an idol. But it says, a workman casts an idol, and a goldsmith overlays it with gold. It is God who sits above the circle of the earth, who brings princes to nothing, and makes the rulers of the earth as nothing. Our whole passage this morning in Isaiah 40 is a series of questions directed toward the people of Israel in exile. They question God's power. They question his strength. They question his ability to help them anymore. And it's all put in the form of a disputation in a law court. That becomes even more true in the next chapter. But all the way through this, the people of Israel are doubting and they're challenging whether God is even able to bring them new salvation again in the worst circumstances possible. And their challenges to God, their doubts, all come to focus in that verse 27. They say, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God. One commentator says, although Israel's words here have a pious ring to them, they mask a small faith that could not conceive of God acting in the world beyond the boundaries of Israel's own experience. He says their belief is short-sighted. And then he goes on. He says the great issue for us is how do we keep hope in God's ability to save us when that confession seems to contradict everything that we're experiencing. And he says, Isaiah's powerful answer is that God is the creator who is far more than even the sum total of our experience. God is incomprehensible and incomparable to anything we can imagine. Therefore, it's impossible to say at any time under any circumstances that our way is hidden from God or that God is indifferent to our situation in life, even when the situation suggests otherwise. And he says to believe that takes radical belief. But then he says the Christian faith is grounded in radical belief. Nothing in our life experience would lead us to the conclusion of Jesus' resurrection. There was a sad episode among many sad episodes in Marilyn Monroe's life. Some of you here don't even know who Marilyn Monroe is, probably. It was when she was married to the playwright Arthur Miller. In his autobiography, Miller talks about their marriage. Apparently, during the filming of the movie, The Misfits, he watched Marilyn, in his words, descend into the depths of depression and despair. And he says he was fearing for her life as he watched their growing estrangement and watched her paranoia and her growing dependence on barbiturates. He says, one evening after the doctor had been persuaded another time to give her another shot and she was sleeping, he says, I stood there watching her and reflecting, and I found myself straining to imagine miracles. What if she were to wake up and I were able to say to her, darling, God loves you. And what if she were able to believe it? He says, how I wish I still had my religion and she had hers. Everything that's said about God in Isaiah 40, God's greatness, his awesomeness, his sovereignty, his incomparability, all of it is answered and fulfilled in what those last verses proclaim. Israel is reminded about what they already know. They're reminded that God is great beyond our human thought, beyond our reach, and beyond our imagination, and that God will save us. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint and strength to the powerless. Even youth shall faint and grow weary, and the young shall fall exhausted. But those who hope in the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. God will help us when we feel helpless. God will strengthen us when we don't have any strength left. God will give us hope when we're hopeless. And when we least expect it, there will be the risen Christ right there with us. Amen.